Nuclear resistors. These are the people who proudly claim the label activist and peacefully stand up for their anti-nuclear beliefs, no matter what the consequences. People who lead by their actions, not because they have a title or are dubbed important in advance, just individuals who do what is in their hearts to do to try and turn around this lemming-like stampede over the edge into nuclear oblivion before it's too late. Mainstream media doesn't pay them much attention, and rarely in a favorable context. But these are heroes and sheroes who blaze an inspiring trail of action. So when someone who has been tracking nuclear resistors for more than 45 years cites just one of those stories of resistance, and he tells us,
"We walked inside and opened up cases that would carry destructive power 30 times the power of the bomb that was dropped in Hiroshima, Japan in 1945. Standing in front of these nose cones that we pulled out of the cases, we held up our hammers and baby bottles filled with human blood, a symbol of the life that had been shed because of these weapons. And we destroyed those two nose cones. We hammered on them until they were incapable of being used by anybody to kill. When Molly Rush brought her hammer down on one of the nose cones, a piece of it chipped off and struck her chin. And the thought came to her, they're not really invulnerable. They really are not. We're vulnerable, but so are they." And Molly realized, that means that human beings have made these, and human beings can unmake them.
Well, when you hear Jack Cohen-Joppa, co-coordinator and co-editor of The Nuclear Resistor, share stories of positive turning points in the battle against nuclear proliferation, you gain heart and hope that we will find our finding a way out of that awful, dangerous, deadly seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat, what are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat, what have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat, the corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat, it's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. We're a show for people who know nothing about nuclear who would like to know something, and people who know something about nuclear who would like to know just a little bit more. My name is Libby Halevi. I'm the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away, so I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, a look back at a full year of inspiring stories about those who resisted nuclear encroachment and expansion, fought back in peaceful ways, took the hit society unleashed to try and stop them, and not only kept going, but kept the rest of us going by example. Today is Tuesday, December 30th, 2025, and here is this week's year-end special. Nuclear resistors, heroes, sheroes, and success. Traditionally, the last nuclear hot seat of the year is a compendium from our regular feature, Numbnuts of the Week, which recounts the dumbest, most short-sighted, or evil actions the nuclear industry and its supporters have committed throughout the year. Well, I don't know about you, but I am tired of giving mental time and space to bad news, especially bad nuclear news, bad nuclear actors, acts, and soul-deadening realizations that the nuclear inmates really are trying to seize control of the energy asylum. Instead, I want to highlight some more positive stories from our shared history of activism. To that end, a little over a year ago, Nuclear Hot Seat introduced you to a new feature, Jack Cohen-Joppa of The Nuclear Resistor, telling stories of nuclear resistance. Jack, along with Felice Cohen-Joppa, founded the Nuclear Resistor in 1980 as a newsletter, reporting on anti-nuclear and anti-war civil resistance actions with a focus on supporting activists imprisoned for these acts of conscience. In almost 45 years, the Nuclear Resistor, a Chronicle of Hope, has reported on more than 100,000 stories. And Jack has kindly shared one of these stories a month on Nuclear Hot Seat. I've come to liken Jack's mellifluously voiced reports to milk and cookies bedtime stories, the kind that make us feel good because the heroes are genuine, and with virtually no resources have been able to severely dent and embarrass, if not stop, the behemoth nuclear industry. David versus Goliath, with multiple examples of David winning. It's good stuff. So here is a compilation of Nuclear Resistor stories, written and voiced by Jack Cohen-Joppa, timeless stories of hope to inspire your activism in the coming years. We start with the introductory inaugural report from Nuclear Hot Seat number 695 on October 15, 2024.
Nuclear resistors are the people who face arrest and jail to say no to nukes. Since 1980, my wife Felice and I have been reporting on their arrests, trials, and time behind bars through the Nuclear Resistor newsletter, and now also online at nuclearresistor.org. We've chronicled over 50,000 such arrests and supported hundreds of people in jail and prison for all manner of creative, determined, risky, and altogether inspiring nonviolent actions against the nuclear threat. I'm excited to be sharing some of these stories with you on Nuclear Hot Seat. So who were the first nuclear resistors? Back at the birth of the atomic bomb in 1945, before many of us were born, one of them was a Danish immigrant in his 30s named Bent Andresen. During the Great Depression, Bent attended Columbia University, joined the Socialist Party and the War Resisters League, got married, and worked as a union organizer while promoting the cooperative movement. So it was not surprising that when the United States entered the Second World War, Bent was among the more than 40,000 men who registered as conscientious objectors. There were so many objectors that the government set up a new program. The Civilian Public Service, CPS, was an option to do work of national importance under civilian direction that allowed war refusers to serve their country without betraying their principles. Bent Andresen signed up. At a civilian public service camp in Michigan, he served his country by living in a refrigerated room for 3 months with several other conscientious objectors for a study of high-protein diets in cold weather conditions. And then he was sent west to the CPS camp in Minersville, California. Soon after he arrived, on August 6, 1945, the United States dropped the A-bomb on Hiroshima. Bent Andresen was appalled, and in protest, he went AWOL, absent without leave, and he walked out of the camp. Years later, for a CPS history project, he wrote of what he did next. "I drafted and mimeographed 5,000 copies of my protest statement and took off to hitchhike to New York City, where my wife was living. I gave out hundreds of copies on street corners in cities I passed through, single copies to all those who gave me rides. Only once was I ejected, and only once did the police apprehend me on the assumption that I was wanted by the FBI. In New York City, I told the DA where I was staying and offered to come in when he wanted to see me. Eventually, he told me to report to Sacramento, California for trial. When I refused to provide my own transportation, I was locked up until two deputies were assigned to transport me. At night, they put me in leg irons and handcuffs in the railroad sleeper. When we got to San Francisco City Jail, I stopped eating. When the authorities in Sacramento County Jail found I wasn't eating, they took me to court. The judge ordered me to county hospital for forced feeding and psychiatric exam. Subsequently, the judge sentenced me to 2 years. Before long, I was transported by marshals to the Medical Center for Federal Prisoners at Springfield, Missouri. I was on total fast, no food or water willingly, for 8 months. When I had served 7 months at Springfield, the deputy warden told me they were going to let me go, and I was put on a train for New York City. So, Bent Andresen was again together with his wife. They eventually settled in Bucks County, Pennsylvania, where Bent remained an activist for a peaceful nuclear-free world until his death in 1991 at age 83. This has been Jack Cohen-Joppa for Nuclear Hot Seat with this story from the Nuclear Resistor Archives to inspire your activism today.
50 years ago, in a classic case of civil disobedience, a young anti-nuclear activist toppled a tower and blazed a trail through the courtroom that nuclear resistors have followed ever since. From Nuclear Hot Seat number 702, December 3rd, 2024.
Today's nuclear resistance story is about probably the first nonviolent direct action to stop an American nuclear power project. It was 1973, and the fantasy of 1,000 American peaceful atom reactors was playing out across the land. Scores of small communities found themselves in crosshairs as perfect sites for the perfect energy technology. In the Connecticut River Valley of western Massachusetts, Sam Lovejoy grew up working in a neighbor's orchard. After college, he fell naturally into organic farming as part of a commune in the village of Montague. When local officials began quietly meeting with nuclear utility execs, Sam's commune and a few neighbors grew concerned. They educated themselves and tried to raise the alarm, but got little response. Then a 500-foot-tall weather observation tower was erected, looking like a radio antenna rising high above the Montague Plain. A small network of activists were sure it had something to do with a yet-to-be-announced nuclear power plant. Sam Lovejoy told a friend, "You're going to have to tip it over, or someone's going to get a movement going here in the valley to stop the nukes." Their worry was confirmed in late December when Northeast Nuclear Utilities went public with plans to build 2 new reactors next to the river in Montague. 2 months later, February 22, 1974, George Washington's birthday. Cherry trees. Weather towers. On that crisp, clear winter night, Sam Lovejoy gathered a few tools from the farm. He approached a cable anchor farthest from the tower and started loosening the turnbuckle. Taking precaution to avoid injury, when the high-tension cables snapped free, he slowly turned the crowbar. When, with a sudden loud twang, twang, the cable whipped free, but the tower held fast. He freed a second cable, then a third. He watched the slender tower as it twisted slightly, rocked a bit, then suddenly buckled and fell in pieces to the ground. Lovejoy ran back to the road and flagged down a passing patrol car for a ride to the police station. He handed over a typed statement condemning the nuclear industry, concluding that, quote, "Through positive action and a sense of moral outrage, I seek to test my convictions."
"Did you write this?" asked the desk sergeant.
"Yeah."
"Is this your signature on the last page?"
"Yeah."
"Holy cow, I'm going to have to arrest you."
Overnight, the public sabotage of a nuclear project became the talk of western Massachusetts. While some decried the, quote, "vandalism," for many others it was nonviolent civil disobedience in a long Yankee tradition. That spring, 3 neighboring towns passed resolutions opposing the nuke. A similar resolution failed in Montague, but by a much smaller margin than predicted, while Lovejoy got over 100 votes to represent his precinct in town meetings. And beyond evidence for the old Union adage that direct action gets the goods, Sam's action and his subsequent trial for felony malicious destruction of private property also embodied themes still seen in the movement today. Sam insisted on representing himself, a tactic that often humanizes the defendant for jurors and usually allows for less constrained testimony. He called 2 expert witnesses, Manhattan Project physicist Dr. John Goffman as an expert on radiation and human health, and historian Dr. Howard Zinn on the vital role of civil disobedience in American democracy. Such testimony remains a powerful tool for educating local media and courtroom observers, even when jurors are sometimes, as in Sam Lovejoy's case, kept from hearing it as a matter of law. Sam then introduced evidence that the tower was not in fact private property, but had been taxed as real property. The judge, already visibly moved by the expert testimony he'd considered and Sam's knowledge and tenacity, found cause in the faulty charge to order the jury to find him not guilty.
The next day, Northeast Nuclear Utilities put plans for the Montague nuke on hold, first for 1 year, later for four more, before finally abandoning it in the face of the growing anti-nuclear power movement of the 1970s, an early victory. This has been Jack Cohen-Joppa for Nuclear Hot Seat, with another story from the Nuclear Resistor Archives to inspire your activism today.
By the way, that farm in western Massachusetts had among its members a very young Harvey Wasserman. This was his introduction to nuclear activism, and he coined the term no nukes. Then he turned around and used what he learned from this action and so many others to fuel his activism for multiple decades since then. Now, there's something about a train. And in the early 1980s, anti-nuclear activists from coast to coast turned that truth into a successful campaign that literally drove the bombs off the rails. From Nuclear Hot Seat number 726, May 27, 2025.
Ever wondered how nuclear bombs get where they're going? Not to their targets, but from the factory to the bases where they're stockpiled and deployed. In the early 1980s, activists in Washington State at the Ground Zero Center for Nonviolent Action learned that a special set of railroad cars was delivering nuclear warheads to the naval base Kitsap Bangor for loading onto the then-new Trident ballistic missile submarines. The bombs rode the rails from the Pantex warhead assembly factory in Amarillo, Texas, to bunkers at the Kitsap Bangor base on Washington's Puget Sound and to the East Coast Naval Weapons Station in South Carolina. Each train was centered around a few armored cars holding the deadly cargo. Buffer cars and escort cars topped with gun turrets for the security team were added to each end, and you couldn't miss them. They were painted all white to keep the contents cool. They ran the same routes as commercial trains, but no faster than 35 miles an hour, slowing even more when they passed through cities and towns along the way. Ground Zero consulted with railroad buffs and reached out to dozens of peace groups along the likely train routes. Together, the Tracks campaign began to document each shipment with photos and video, sending word down the line to the next group who would alert the local media and protest the doomsday cargo rolling through their town. The Catholic Bishop of Amarillo and the Archbishop of Seattle both endorsed the campaign and enlisted the public support of nearly a dozen other bishops along the tracks. A Mennonite volunteer from Colorado moved to Amarillo to keep a prayerful watch and alert others when the trains departed, and soon there were vigils greeting the trains in more than 300 communities along the rails between Pantex and the nuclear submarine bases. The nuclear train that left Pantex in late March of 1983 was the first to meet nonviolent resistance. In Colorado, two men were busted trying to stop the train in Denver. 60 miles on in Fort Collins, eight people, mostly teachers and parents, were cleared from the tracks and arrested. And six more arrests were made when the train confronted 200 people outside the Bangor Gate. Over the next 18 months, five such trains each provoked multiple blockades, leading to the arrests of nearly 400 people across eight states. Several people were jailed for a day or a week, while a few served two or more months in jail. When one train tried to avoid protest hotspots and take a longer route over the Rockies to Bangor, it still encountered nonviolent resistors in rural northern Montana at both Conrad, population 2,500, and Whitefish, population 4,000, where dozens had turned out to protest. When the next train to Bangor took the same route, three people blocked it in Whitefish. One man was sentenced to 5 days in jail, and furthermore, ordered to report back to jail 24 hours before the next nuclear train came through town, where he would be held until it passed by. By then, the train had been repainted in earth tones to, quoting a 1984 memorandum, make tracking our trains more difficult. But the transport of nuclear warheads by rail was doomed. Trains just can't avoid what or who lies ahead on the tracks. In the tradition of the Plowshares movement of direct disarmament, that point was hammered home on July 16, 1985, the 40th anniversary of the first atomic bomb test. After proper placement of railroad hazard warnings, Richard Miller used a crowbar to remove two rails from the tracks leading out of Pantex. Miller riddled, "What is the difference between Pantex and Auschwitz?" and answered, "At Auschwitz, the trains carried the people to the crematoria. At Pantex, the trains carry the crematoria to the people." 3 weeks later, in a secret document dated August 6th, Hiroshima Day, 1985, and later released under the Freedom of Information Act, the government confirmed, in all caps, that the nuclear trains would be sidelined, quote, "in view of the growing anti-nuclear movement in the United States with its apparent focus on the White Death Train." Since then, a custom fleet of tractor-trailer trucks with armed escorts has been hauling doom on the nation's highways. Their appearance, in turn, sparked the H-bomb truck watch, but that's a story for another day. For now, this has been Jack Cohen-Java for Nuclear Hot Seat, hoping this story from the Nuclear Resistor Archives will inspire your activism today.
35 years ago, rural communities in western New York took nonviolent direct action to bump the dump, stopping the state and the nuclear industry from trashing their countryside with so-called low-level nuclear waste. Here's the true tale of how two counties stood up and shut the door when the nuclear industry came knocking. Originally broadcast on Nuclear Hot Seat number 717 from March 25th, 2025.
People in western New York were pissed off. In December 1988, the State Low-Level Radioactive Waste Siting Commission announced that 10 sites in rural western counties were the best spots for the state's so-called low-level radioactive waste dump, mandated by federal law. The reaction was fast and fierce. In Cortland County, more than 3,000 people attended the commission's first public info meeting on January 23rd. After what they heard, 1,300 returned the very next day to occupy the county office building, filling the halls with chants of "bump the dump." 3 days later, and 100 miles farther west, the same roadshow arrived to explain their plan at Belfast Central High School. There, concerned citizens of Allegheny County were leading a public education campaign that had snowballed, and 5,000 people showed up, a full 10% of that county's population. They overflowed from the gymnasium to other rooms and finally outside, where most heard the raucous meeting through loudspeakers. One after another, residents stood to condemn a selection process skewed against them while decrying the radioactive threat to the health and property values of their farming community. The commissioners, in turn condescending and callous, did nothing to moderate the accelerating reaction. The crowd whooped and hollered when one man summed up their resolve and told the commission, "We will fight this decision every step of the way. We will fight you in the halls of science. We will fight you in the courts of law. We will fight you in the legislature, and if necessary, we will fight you in the streets." And they did. Hundreds of creative and informative projects sprang up. Parades and posters, cooking and cartoons, fine art, theater, quilting, and more. All to raise money, meet allies, and fortify their opposition. Signs and banners adorned businesses, barns, and homes. But the Siting Commission plowed ahead. Next step, windshield surveys driving to each site. Believing this scenario was ripe for civil disobedience, the Allegheny County Nonviolent Action Group came together and began training dozens of new activists to peacefully block the site surveys. In Cortland County, the Citizens Against Radioactive Dumping did the same. And when commissioners returned to Allegheny County in May, dozens of locals surrounded their car, preventing them from entering the site. The county sheriff reluctantly made 48 arrests. When they were released from custody, courthouse workers cheered and held anti-dump signs from the windows. The people knew there'd be more surveys at each site, so they set up networks of road monitors using citizens' band radio and telephone trees to mobilize blockaders every time the city's slicker commissioners rolled in. From December 89 to April 1990, 4 blockades at the Allegheny sites and 2 in Cortland County led to over 140 arrests and prevented agents from surveying any of the 5 sites. Another 21 people had been arrested during 2 weeks of blocking the Dump Project storefront in Cincinnati. Cortland County District Attorney allied with the activists there and dropped disorderly conduct charges, telling Governor Cuomo that the actions of the commission were simply ludicrous and inflammatory. The campaign reached its dramatic climax on April 5, 1990, when all 9 possible routes to the Canadeo site were blocked. State police escorting the survey team first had to arrest 6 grandparents for the future, one in a wheelchair, who had handcuffed themselves to a chain blocking the old Genesee River Iron Bridge. Delayed for hours, police then pressed on toward the site 2 miles away. Now many farm implements blocked the road, and troopers had to march through the mud to get by. The last line of resistance was mounted horses, their experienced riders turning the horses' rears toward the advancing cops, who soon sparked a melee, clubbing horses and knocking riders from their mounts while making 31 more arrests. The next day, the governor of New York, who'd been claiming he had no authority over the work of the independent commission, put a halt to the site surveys. Later, a grand jury dismissed all charges while recommending more training for state police. Fast forward 2 years, and the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that the federal government may not force state governments to take title to nuclear waste, and the rural sites were removed from consideration. This has been Jack Cohen-Joppa for Nuclear Hot Seat, bringing you another story from the Nuclear Resistor Archives to inspire your activism today.
In 1980, the Plowshares 8 hammered on nuclear warhead nose cones and sparked a global movement of direct action for nuclear disarmament. Here's Jack Cohen-Joppa with the inspiring story that was originally heard on Nuclear Hot Seat number 713 from February 25th, 2025.
The work of the nuclear resistor began back in 1980 when anti-nuclear power alliances and groups protesting the nuclear arms race were mushrooming up across the country. Friends had gone to jail for some of these protests, and we believed that more were headed there as these movements grew. History had taught us that in any significant movement for social change, many committed people are imprisoned, and that support for them is essential to the success of the movement. That awareness has been the foundation of our work for the past 45 years. When putting together the first issue of the small newsletter that would become the Nuclear Resistor, I read an article about the arrest of 8 people inside a General Electric factory outside Philadelphia. They were in jail and facing multiple charges for intentionally smashing 2 nuclear warhead nose cones and pouring blood on blueprints. It was serendipity that this daring act of direct disarmament became the only action, and these were the only jailed activists reported in that first issue. So who were these people? Later known as the Plowshares 8, they'd come together through the Atlantic Life Community, a network of faith-based communities and activists focused on the issue of nuclear proliferation with a specific commitment to resistance actions and civil disobedience. They were the brothers Daniel and Philip Berrigan, Catholic priests known for burning draft board records to protest the war in Vietnam, the Oblate missionary priest Carl Cabot, Anne Montgomery, an educator and Society of the Sacred Heart nun, Elmer Moss, a musician and scholar, Marine Corps veteran and attorney John Shushart, Yale Divinity School student Dean Hammer, and Molly Rush, a mother of 6. Early on the morning of September 9th, these 8 had joined hundreds of workers walking into the GE factory in a town named King of Prussia, Pennsylvania. Entering the building where they believed parts for nuclear weapons were being assembled, they pushed their way past an unarmed security guard. Elmer Moss described what happened next. "We walked inside and opened up cases that would carry destructive power, 30 times the power of the bomb that was dropped in Hiroshima, Japan in 1945. Standing in front of these nose cones that we pulled out of the cases, we held up our hammers and baby bottles filled with human blood, a symbol of the life that had been shed because of these weapons. And we destroyed those 2 nose cones. We hammered on them until they were incapable of being used by anybody to kill." When Molly Rush brought her hammer down on one of the nose cones, a piece of it chipped off and struck her chin. And the thought came to her, they're not really invulnerable. They really are not. We're vulnerable, but so are they. And Molly realized, that means that human beings have made these, and human beings can unmake them. In their statement, they declared inspiration from the Old Testament prophets Isaiah and Micah, who called on God's faithful to beat their swords into plowshares and spears into pruning hooks. The Plowshares 8 had begun this fundamentally human task of nuclear disarmament. Their hammers sparked a movement, their sound echoing around the globe in more than 100 such Plowshares actions since, each a story to tell in itself. More than 200 people have taken part, some in more than one action, and served up to 18 years in prison. About 60 of these actions have taken place in the United States and more than 40 abroad, in Australia, New Zealand, Germany, Holland, Sweden, Italy, Scotland, and England. A full chronology can be found on the Kings Bay Plowshares 7 website. The dramatic trial of the Plowshares 8 was recreated by Emile D'Antonio for his 1982 arthouse film, In the King of Prussia. Starring Martin Sheen as the judge and the defendants as themselves, it was filmed on the eve of their sentencing, and you can watch it on YouTube. They were sentenced to prison terms of 5 to 10 years. After years of appeals, they were resentenced in 1990 to time served, from 5 days to almost 10 months. And their legacy lives on. This has been Jack Cohen-Japa for Nuclear Hot Seat, bringing you another story from the Nuclear Resistor Archives to inspire your activism today.
We will continue with this week's special year-end look at nuclear activist heroes and sheroes and the extraordinary steps they took to stop nukes. But before I do, congratulations! By the time you hear this, we will have made it through another year without blowing ourselves to smithereens or terminally irradiating ourselves. Huzzah! Our survival, you know, is not a given. What with the nuclear saber rattling and threats between nations, radiation leaks, deadly radioactive waste, and the sudden AI push for electricity generation by promoting new, refurbished, and or back-from-the-dead zombie nuclear reactors. The Chinese curse, may you live in interesting times, has never been more spot on. But it's also a challenge for us to come up with ways to resist and ultimately prevail. To help keep your spirits up, this week's show features an entire year of nuclear resistor stories, putting us in touch with a history of successes you probably didn't even know we shared. I know I didn't. That's one of the joys of producing Nuclear Hot Seat. Learning nuclear facts we were obviously not supposed to know or remember, and then being able to share it with all of you so that you can then share it with others, and so on. In this way, our history lives and our future becomes more tangible, because others have succeeded and we can too. And of primary importance in fighting back, knowing the truth, the news, the issues, the people in our community, and names of those who continue to fight against nuclear encroachment, no matter what form it takes. And that is why you need Nuclear Hot Seat. Here's where you can find all that information, interviews with genuine experts, and an alternative narrative to mainstream media talking points lifted straight from nuclear industry propaganda. But in order to continue to do this work in a new year, we need your help. Nuclear Hot Seat runs exclusively on donations and cannot survive without your support. So as we face a new year, if you're grateful for the information you get here, now is the time to help us out. Nuclear Hot Seat is a 501c3 nonprofit organization, which means that your donation is tax deductible. And we make it easy. Go to nuclearhotseat.com, no fees, via Zelle, to info@nuclearhotseat.com. Be it a one-time donation or monthly recurring, even $5 for the equivalent of a cup of coffee. You'll be supporting the services required to keep this program running. So don't wait. Go to nuclearhotseat.com to donate now and help keep our nuclear news online. Whatever you can do to help, I am deeply grateful that you're listening and that you care. Now, back to this year's special year-end program, Stories of Nuclear Resistors, Heroes, and Successes to uplift us in our efforts in the coming year. Activism against nukes was hardly limited to the United States. In a legendary anti-nuclear victory, British women came together at the Greenham Common Women's Peace Camp and succeeded in kicking U.S. nuclear missiles out of England. Here's the Nuclear Resistor Report from Nuclear Hot Seat number 709, January 28, 2025.
In the Nuclear Resistor office, we have a squiggly piece of heavy wire coated with green plastic, a treasured trophy from a legendary anti-nuclear victory, a victory won by women. There's even a song about it from folk legend Peggy Seeger.
Hand in hand, the line extends all around the 9-mile fence. 30,000 women chant, bring the message home. Carry Greenham home, yes, near home and far away. Carry Greenham home.
When I visited the Greenham Common Women's Peace Camp almost 30 years ago, the women gave me that small artifact from the chain link fence that once surrounded a British airbase where U.S. nuclear missiles were deployed and then kicked out. From 1981 through the year 2000, women committed to nonviolent action to end the threat of nuclear war camped outside the gates of the Royal Air Force Base at Greenham Common, despite violent intimidation and repeated evictions, hundreds of arrests, and multiple jail terms. Back in 1980, the base had been picked to host the first deployment of U.S. nuclear-armed ground-launched cruise missiles. It was the height of the Cold War nuclear arms race, and these new missiles and their companion Pershing missiles being deployed at NATO bases across Europe were a colossal escalation of first-strike nuclear threats. Compared to ICBMs, these new intermediate-range missiles cut the flight time to incinerate Moscow in half. So in the summer of 1981, a few dozen women from Wales began a 100-mile peace march to Greenham Common. When they arrived in early September, four of the women chained themselves to the fence. Guards taunted them to stay as long as you want, so they did. The first missiles would not arrive until late 1983, but the women's audacious action and its mission proved a contagious idea. Soon, women across generations and backgrounds flocked by the hundreds to join the peace camp, now at all 8 gates into the base. Guided by feminist principles, they organized themselves without hierarchy and without designated leaders who could be targeted by police and the hostile media. Allied peace camps sprang up at bases across Europe and in the U.S. The major demonstrations at Greenham created iconic images of feminist war resistance. In December 1982, the 30,000 women that Peggy Seeger sings about joined arms to embrace the base, fully encircling it while other women cut the fence and occupied the missile bunkers under construction. The next April, 50,000 people formed a 14-mile human chain connecting Greenham to the nuclear bomb factories at Aldermaston and Burfield. And in October, just days before the first missiles arrived, 400 women cut down over 2,000 yards of that 9-mile fence, and nearly 200 were arrested. Despite media silence once the missiles had arrived, the women persisted. The nuclear war planners had imagined that mobile convoys of cruise missile launchers would blend into the countryside, their location hidden from the Soviets. But the fact that women were camped at the gates, primed for action and working with Cruise Watch, a network of civilian spotters, made sure that the location of each and every one of 68 convoys that roamed the Salisbury Plain from the spring of 84 to the summer of 1990 was known to the world. Women sometimes cut through the fence to damage and occupy convoy vehicles before they even left the base. Any tactical value of hidden missiles was totally obliterated by public protest inside the base, at the gates, on the roads, and in the villages the convoys raced through on their way to the training sites. Even Soviet Premier Gorbachev agreed that there could be no doubt that the committed women who held their ground at the peace camp and the millions of people they inspired into action worldwide played a significant role when he and President Reagan in 1987 signed the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty. As a result, The cruise missiles were all withdrawn from Europe by 1991, their warheads removed, and the missiles themselves ceremoniously cut to pieces right here in Tucson, Arizona. The U.S. Air Force departed Greenham the next year, and the base was closed. The women remained until 2000, ensuring that the commons was finally returned to the community. In 2002, a commemorative memorial garden was dedicated at the now historic campsite. But as we know, the nuclear planners did not go away, and long after those last U.S. nuclear weapons left Britain, they are now set to return. The U.S. F-35s at RAF Lakenheath could soon have their own American nukes. But opposition is building. The Lakenheath Alliance for Peace is hosting a peace camp there from April 14th to the 25th, 2025. For more information, visit lakenheathallianceforpeace.org.uk. This has been Jack Cohen-Joppa for Nuclear Hot Seat with another story from the Nuclear Resistor Archives to inspire your activism today.
Missouri is known as the Show Me State, and the Missouri Peace Planters did just that when they repeatedly occupied multiple nuclear missile silos in the summer of 1988, causing a furor that helped raise awareness of this hidden danger at the height of the Cold War. From Nuclear Hot Seat number 722, April 29, 2025.
West of the Mississippi River, across the American heartland, nuclear missiles have long been hidden in farmers' fields like razors in a loaf of bread. That disturbing metaphor drew about 50 Midwesterners together in the summer of 1988 to talk and pray about the nuclear missiles in their midst. In recent years, more than a dozen nuclear abolitionists had entered the sites of the buried silos across several states and had gone to jail, including Plowshares activists who had damaged the silo lids and above-ground instruments. And these protests were not just symbolic. With every action at a silo, even simple trespass, that missile is taken offline, if only temporarily. Sam Day, one of the organizers of the retreat, told some of their story for a book he edited in 1989 entitled Prisoners on Purpose, A Peacemaker's Guide to Jails and Prisons. Over a long weekend in Milwaukee with a vision of broadening participation and nonviolent direct actions at the silos, the group engaged with the philosophical and tactical issues of resistance. They role-played possible scenarios, from the action itself through arrest, jail, trial, and imprisonment, and they emerged with a plan to touch the nation's conscience by putting protesters on top of multiple nuclear missile silos. They called it the Missouri Peace Planting 88, and their plan marked a significant escalation in the numbers of people involved, in the breadth of preparation, and in the openness of its summons to nonviolent resistance. At dawn on Monday, August 15th, a caravan of cars drove south from Kansas City, dropping off teams of activists and observers at missile launch sites across three counties. At precisely 7 a.m., all the peace planters went to work. Some scaled fences and others cut padlocks on the gates, and within minutes, 14 activists stood directly above 10 different Minuteman II missile silos. They reclaimed the land for peace. They planted seeds, hung banners, and left personal artifacts and family photos. At one silo, a white-haired grandmother climbed the fence as television and still cameras recorded the scene. And at another launch site, Sam Day, dressed as a clown, strolled onto the silo lid and tied balloons to the instruments. Alerted by remote sensors, Air Force security teams scrambled to each site. The peace planters were all soon arrested, along with a few of their support people. They were taken to the county jails and released later that day. The Air Force was caught unprepared, and they chose not to prosecute, deciding instead to issue letters warning the offenders not to do it again. But their plan was to persist. The very next day, Tuesday, six of the 14 returned to the silo numbered C-11, where they held a prayer vigil. After a tense but peaceful standoff with Air Force security, they were again arrested, given a second ban and bar letter, and released. On Wednesday, five repeaters and four other resistors returned, this time to Silo N2, where the scene played out again. And on Friday, The peace planters held a press conference on the steps of the Kansas City Federal Courthouse, where they declared their intention to continue the campaign, and nine of them ceremoniously burned the ban and bar letters they had received. Dwayne Bean and Kathy Kelly were arrested again at Silo M8 on August 24th, and again released with just a warning. On August 28th, these two returned with two more women, cut the locks, and entered yet another silo. Well, now the feds changed their tune. Bean and Kelly were jailed on charges of trespass and destruction of property until their arraignment 10 days later. And in short order, 15 peace planters faced federal charges, some for as many as five consecutive actions. Their trials began that fall, and by the following July, a year after that weekend retreat in Milwaukee, all but one of the Missouri peace planters had been convicted, fined, and locked up. Many had refused probation. Each of them were or would be serving time in jail or federal prison. And the last of the group would eventually serve 2 months in jail. Most served the maximum 6-month sentence for trespass, and a few were imprisoned for 12 to 26 months of consecutive terms for multiple arrests and charges. And those buried nuclear missiles? The Air Force recently began silo upgrades intending to replace the Minutemen with the new Sentinel ICBMs. Maybe it's time to be planting some more peace before all these new nuclear missiles take root. This has been Jack Cohen-Joppa for Nuclear Hot Seat with another story for you from the Nuclear Resistor Archives to inspire your activism today.
And here's another entry for Milk and Cookies Time. Another story of heroism in the fight against nuclear weapons with Jack Cohen-Joppa of the Nuclear Resistor. Here, he focuses on the protest events surrounding 1985's 40th anniversary of the U.S. atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. This from August 26, 2025, Nuclear Hot Seat number 739.
Every August, the anniversaries of the atomic bombings beckon us to honor the victims and renew our demand. Hiroshima, Nagasaki, never again. 40 years after the bombings in 1985, the nuclear arms race had reached a crescendo. Popular movements in the U.S. and Europe sought to mute the nuclear threat. Protest and nonviolent resistance had become as much a part of commemorating the atomic anniversaries as prayer vigils, floating lanterns, and folded paper cranes. For that 40th anniversary, two major public art events also brought international attention to the issue. First was the ribbon. On Sunday, August 4th, a human chain holding 15 miles of colorful fabric panels stretched from the Pentagon across the Potomac and through Washington, D.C. Thousands of the handmade panels had been gathered from all 50 states and overseas, each decorated to show what the maker loved most and wanted to protect by abolishing nuclear weapons. And even this fabric folk art caused some good trouble. In late July, the Montana State coordinator of the ribbon had been arrested after he and a colleague hung 18 panels made by Montanans on the security fence surrounding a nuclear missile silo in their state. The second public art event was the International Shadow Project and its worldwide premiere under moonlight on the eve of Hiroshima Day. By dawn on August 6th, 10,000 volunteers in over 300 cities and towns around the globe had used whitewash, chalk, or paint on city streets, sidewalks, and public buildings to create human and animal silhouettes, recalling the haunting images that remained when lives were vaporized by the atomic blasts. Not surprisingly, the After Hours Art Project attracted some unwanted attention, and more than 200 people were arrested in 21 American towns, plus another 200 arrests reported from Canada, England, and Australia. Over the next few days, another 450 people would be arrested during more than 30 civil disobedience actions across North America. Many of these actions featured die-ins and dramatizations of a nuclear attack. On the Santa Monica Boardwalk, in front of the Rand Corporation, 200 people counted down to the launch of two watermelons, painted silver, and named Fat Man and Little Boy after the original bombs. And as these melon bombs hit the ground and exploded, whistles blared, flour and ash were thrown into the air, and the intersection filled with dying activists. 20 were arrested, including 5 charged with felony conspiracy to start a riot. In 1985, nuclear weapons were still being tested at the Nevada test site. 8 national religious peace groups shepherded more than 500 people into this nuclear wilderness for the August Desert Witness to demand the U.S. ratify the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty. 4 days of legal vigils and civil disobedience actions led to another 120 arrests for trespass. Local groups also took action, leading to arrests at nearly a dozen different nuclear contractors across the country. At a GTE facility in Westboro, Massachusetts, 9 people were charged on August 9th after they held photos of Hiroshima and Nagasaki victims, then knelt in prayer and blocked the entrance. They agreed to a bench trial that very afternoon and were found guilty, whereupon 7 refused to pay fines and immediately served up to 10 weeks in the county jail. Arrests were also made at nuclear military bases in at least 9 states, including Pease Air Force Base in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. There, 50 people rallied in support of 5 who walked across the line in protest. Police made no effort to stop 2 of them as they kept walking up to the monument that honors the Air Force unit that dropped the bombs on Japan. The monument itself, it's a grotesque celebration of the atomic pyre. The mushroom cloud cast in bronze, but now lifted by wings, spreading wide above a granite plinth. The activists opened a large white box and ceremoniously poured ashes over the monument, then stood for a moment in the silence of the billowing cloud before their arrest. These hallowed August days are still commemorated each year with acts of anti-nuclear civil disobedience. Recently, on the 80th anniversaries, arrests have been reported during peaceful protests at Livermore Nuclear Lab in California, Lockheed Martin's corporate office in Pennsylvania, and at the Pentagon. This has been Jack Cohen Joppa for Nuclear Hot Seat, sharing more stories from the Nuclear Resistor Archives to inspire your activism today.
And finally, this. A big elf that menaced the Northwoods and threatened the world for 30 years was finally chased out by the teach-ins, petitions, lawsuits, and handsaws of the popular resistance. From November 11, 2025, and Nuclear Hot Seat, number 750.
The most lethal and threatening leg of the United States nuclear trinity of air, land, and sea-launched warheads are the Trident nuclear submarines. They run silent and deep beneath all 7 seas. But the same deep oceans where submarines can hide also complicate communication with commanders on shore. One solution was to use low or extremely low frequency radio waves. Decades ago, deep in the North Woods of Wisconsin and Michigan's Upper Peninsula, over 80 miles of large aluminum cable was strung from thousands of wood utility poles. Anchored deep in the granite bedrock, they created a ground-based antenna known as Project ELF for extremely low frequency transmission. But the extremely low frequency is also extremely slow. Think 15 minutes for a 3-letter code, and the sub can't even reply. Project ELF was designed to send one-way messages to submerged Trident submarines, calling them to the surface to take the launch order for a nuclear first strike. The sole function of Project ELF was to simply ring the bell to start a nuclear war. Naturally, the Northwoods locals took offense to this foolhardy project to electrify the forests where they work and play just to win the war that will end the world. So even before the linesmen got to work, the Stop Project ELF campaign arose to educate the public in both states about the health risk of ELF and the existential risk of its mission. Experts testified that ELF's military necessity was highly overrated. Opponents gathered enough political support to get Wisconsin's Attorney General to sue the Navy over the environmental violations. And amid the growing waves of anti-nuclear civil disobedience in the 1980s, the Citizens for Alternatives to Trident ELF took up a parallel campaign of nonviolent direct action. Between 1983 and 1987, almost 40 people were arrested for climbing fences at the 2 transmitter sites in Michigan and Wisconsin. 3 men in separate actions each used handsaws to cut through one or more of the poles, risking injury to slow construction and testing of the system, and each served up to 22 months in state custody. Meanwhile, in 1984, a federal judge agreed that the Navy was violating federal law because it had ignored studies showing human health hazards from ELF's electromagnetic radiation. When that ruling was vacated on appeal, the legal path to stop Project ELF reached a dead end, and ELF began full operations in 1989. Direct action advocates took a step back to regroup. In 1991, NukeWatch, a scrappy nonprofit out of Madison, picked up the baton for a growing coalition still determined to chase this ELF out of the woods. NukeWatch even moved to northern Wisconsin, and over the next 13 years, a renewed direct action campaign supported nearly 60 nonviolent actions at the Wisconsin facility, resulting in 600 more arrests. Some repeat resistors racked up four or more citations. Many refused to pay fines, and at least 40 people served days or even months in jail instead. And for a time, the court even suspended driver's licenses for unpaid fines. But the courts were not a total bust. On Earth Day 1996, Tom Hastings and Donna Howard, in a Plowshares action they named the Laurentian Shield after that granite bedrock, took a two-handled saw and cut down three more poles. At trial that September, they won a jury acquittal on state sabotage charges after expert testimony showed that Project ELF and Trident can only be used in a manner that violates U.S. law against war crimes of indiscriminate death and destruction. When county officials eventually grew weary of carrying the Navy's water in court, the federal government took over prosecutions in 2001, and some ELF activists spent up to 6 months in federal prison, including NukeWatch organizer Bonnie Erfer. Then, in September 2004, the continuing resistance came to a sudden and surprising end. The Navy announced that ELF would be turned off and dismantled at the end of that month. It was outdated and no longer needed, they said, the same argument opponents had been making for 30 years. This ELF was evicted, and direct action, including over 9 years of peace witness from behind bars, finally got the goods. The last 20 people awaiting trial in federal court had their charges dismissed as moot. This has been Jack Cohen Joppa for Nuclear Hot Seat with another tale from the archives of the Nuclear Resistor to inspire your activism today.
So what will it take now to move our own actions forward? To be inspired by these tales of activism and sacrifice past, which led to a lessening, if not a complete stop, to various aspects of nuclear actions. If you've got something going and want the world to know, get word to us here at Nuclear Hot Seat, and we will share your story with our listeners. For now, our thanks to Jack Cohen Joppa and Felice Cohen Joppa, I know you guys work together, for this set of stories about nuclear resistance, and we look forward to what you have to share with us in the coming year. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, December 30th, 2025. If you'd like to get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered by email every week, it is the best way for you to guarantee that you never miss out on a single episode. We make it easy. You can sign up for it on our website at nuclearhotseat.com. You'll see a yellow opt-in box, so just put in your first name and an email address, and every week you will get an email with a link to that week's show and a brief summary of the material that is included within it. Or if you're a steady consumer of podcasts, go to your favorite podcast provider and sign up there. Now, we get our best leads from you, the listeners, because if you've got a nuclear story in your area, you're up close and personal with the details in ways that we're not. So let us know. Send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com, and we'll follow up with you to find out what's going on. And remember, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, thank you. Any amount will help us out, and we really appreciate your support. It's what we need in order to keep going. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2025, Libby Halevi and Nuclear Hot Seat. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as you cite the program, website, names of any guests whose comments you use, and me. For now, this is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you that, as is cited in Ways of Knowing, a Navajo nuclear history, it is never too late to heal the land. There you have it, your weekly nuclear wake-up call, with another year done and dusted. So we wish you a Happy New Year, a 2026 that is filled with joy, success, happiness, love, contentment, and no nukes. And as always, we remind you that whatever you do in 2026, don't go back to sleep, please. That's because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.